ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Republicans like what they see in Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban. His nationalist policies and centralizing of state power helped him win four consecutive elections. What MAGA's learning from Hungary on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin in Budapest, Hungary.
And I'm Michelle Martin. President Trump called Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine genius. Now he's saying Putin's gone crazy. We hear from the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine about whether this suggests an actual change in policy. Also, how is former oil executive Chris Wright approaching his job as energy secretary and the scourge of monkeys stealing food across Nepal? It is Thursday, May 29th. On this day in 1988, President Ronald Reagan and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev began their fourth summit meeting in Moscow. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. will aggressively revoke visas from many Chinese students. That's after he said the U.S. would scrutinize the social media of prospective students from Hong Kong and China. Mao Ning is the spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry. She's heard here through an interpreter.
The U.S. has unreasonably cancelled Chinese students' visas under the pretext of ideology and national security, which has seriously damaged the legitimate rights and interests of Chinese students and disrupted normal cultural exchanges between the two countries.
She was heard through the BBC. Nearly all of President Trump's worldwide tariffs have been blocked. The little-known U.S. Court of International Trade says Trump cannot use an emergency law to impose them. The three-judge panel ruled only Congress has the exclusive authority to regulate trade and tariffs. President Trump says he's considering pardons for the men convicted of conspiring to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports Trump said he had watched the men's trial.
President Trump said the case against the two men appears to be somewhat of a, quote, railroad job.
I'll be honest with you, it looked to me like some people said some stupid things, you know? They were drinking, and I think they said stupid things. But I'll take a look at that.
Barry Croft Jr. was sentenced to nearly 20 years, while Adam Fox was sentenced to 16 years after being convicted of leading a violent scheme to kidnap Governor Whitmer during the final stretch of the 2020 presidential election. Defense lawyers have claimed the men were victims of entrapment and that government informants egged them on. But last month, a federal appeals court upheld their convictions. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
Native American voters in North Dakota are asking a federal appeals court to review a decision. Critics say it has made it more difficult to enforce protections against racial discrimination in elections in seven states. As NPR's Hansi Lo Wong reports, the case is a step closer to the U.S. Supreme Court, where a decision could weaken the Federal Voting Rights Act.
For decades, private individuals and groups have brought most of the lawsuits focused on enforcing the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, which has protections for ensuring voters of color have an opportunity equal to white voters in electing their preferred candidates in places where voting is racially polarized. But this month, a panel of the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that a part of the federal code known as Section 1983 does not allow private individuals and groups to sue because those private individuals and groups are not explicitly named in the words of the Voting Rights Act. That ruling applies to seven mainly Midwestern states, including Arkansas, Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Now Native American voters in North Dakota, led by the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, are asking all 8 circuit judges to review the ruling, setting up a potential appeal to the Supreme Court. Hansi Lo Wong, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Officials in the Canadian province of Manitoba have declared a state of emergency. Wildfires have forced some 17,000 people to flee. Manitoba lies north of Minnesota and North Dakota. Its premier says this is the largest evacuation in Manitoba's living memory, and the Canadian military is helping. Oklahoma City has advanced to this year's NBA Finals. NPR's Becky Sullivan says the Thunder closed out its series against the Minnesota Timberwolves last night in Game 5 of the Western Conference Finals, 124-94.
In the first quarter, everything went wrong for the Timberwolves, who managed only 9 points. Everything went wrong after that, too. By halftime, Oklahoma City led by 33. And after the final buzzer, the Timberwolves filed out, heads hung low, bounced out of the playoffs just short of the finals for the second year in a row. The 4-1 series win was a dominant showing by Oklahoma City, who had the NBA's best regular season record this year. Their star Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was named most valuable player, and the crowd showered him with chants of MVP as he scored 34 points. Now the Thunder await the outcome of the Eastern Conference Finals. There, the Indiana Pacers lead the New York Knicks 3-1. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
The Florida Panthers are heading back to the Stanley Cup Final for the third year in a row. They beat the Carolina Hurricanes last night 5-3. They won the NHL's best-of-seven series 4-1. The defending Florida Panthers will now play either the Edmonton Oilers or the Dallas Stars. The Edmonton Oilers currently lead that series 3-1. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. For several days now, President Trump has expressed growing frustration with Russian President Vladimir Putin over the slow progress toward ending the war in Ukraine, something he did again yesterday at the White House.
We're going to find out whether or not he's tapping us along or not. And if he is, we'll respond a little bit differently.
Meanwhile, Russia announced it's ready to hold another round of peace talks. In a few minutes, we'll talk about Trump and Putin's relationship with a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, William Taylor. But first, NPR's Charles Maines is on the line with us from Moscow to discuss the latest developments. Hi, Charles. Good morning.
Morning, Michelle.
So let's just start by digging in on Trump's statements. We just heard the president briefly. Remind us, what has he been saying?
You know, this began with Trump expressing anger over Russia's intense bombing of cities across Ukraine over the weekend. Trump initially said Putin had gone absolutely crazy and threatened potential sanctions. That was on Sunday. 2 days later, Trump reminded Moscow that if it hadn't been for him, quote, really bad things would have already happened to Russia. And he warned Putin he was playing with fire. And then yesterday, Trump said he was disappointed that Russia had continued attacks while negotiations were ongoing. Yet on this issue of hitting Russia with new sanctions or some other response, Trump made clear he's not there yet.
If I think I'm close to getting a deal, I don't want to screw it up by doing that. Let me tell you, I'm a lot tougher than the people you're talking about, but you have to know when to use that.
Okay, so some drift in there, but the president is saying he's not happy with Moscow's behavior. So how has the Kremlin responded?
Well, some Kremlin officials have called Trump misinformed, arguing Trump wasn't aware of Ukrainian drone attacks on Russia over the week. More, they also point to a deal Ukraine signed yesterday with Germany to produce long-range weapons capable of striking inside Russia in the future. But overall, the Kremlin strategy appears to be not antagonizing Trump. President Putin has said nothing. Meanwhile, his spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has repeatedly complimented Trump's effort to end the conflict while reminding these are complex negotiations full of nuances. Now, critics will say, of course, that it's just more foot-dragging by Moscow as fighting continues. And yet, Russia's foreign minister announced last night he was now ready to pick up talks where they left off, calling for a meeting with Ukraine in Istanbul, Turkey, next Monday, when each side can present documents outlining their vision for an eventual peace deal.
Okay, what about the Ukrainians? Have they signed on to this meeting?
Well, the presumption is they will, because Kyiv needs to show Trump that Ukraine's not the obstacle to peace here. Certainly that was the case in the first round of talks in Istanbul, negotiations that were proposed by Putin amid earlier sanctions threat by Trump, although Putin then undermined these very talks by sending a relatively low-level delegation.
Is there any reason to be more hopeful with this time around?
Well, I'd say never, not least because Trump has suggested he may be willing to meet with Putin, Zelensky to hammer out a deal. But Ukraine is already accusing Russia of massing troops along its border for a new summer offensive. And Russia's lead negotiator has publicly drawn comparisons between Ukraine and a war Russia had with Sweden back in the 1700s that went on for 21 years. The clear message there that no matter how long it takes, we'll get what's ours. So Trump may face this vexing question that's really been there ever since he waded into the Ukraine conflict at the beginning. You know, what to do if or when he decides Russia isn't serious about wanting to end the war.
That is NPR's Charles Mainz in Moscow. Charles, thank you.
Thank you.
As we've mentioned, President Trump has hardened his tone on Vladimir Putin in recent days, but he has praised the Russian leader many times in the past. In 2022, after his first term, Trump called Putin's invasion of Ukraine genius. Before he was elected president, Trump described the authoritarian leader as smart and tough. So what does Trump's apparent change of tone suggest about future U.S. policy toward Russia? I've called William Taylor to ask him about this. He served as U.S. ambassador to Ukraine under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. He's currently with the Atlantic Council, and he's actually in Ukraine at the moment in Odessa. Ambassador, welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Michelle, thank you very much for having me.
First, what do you make of President Trump's recent change in tone when talking about Vladimir Putin?
So clearly, President Trump's getting irritated, rightly so, frustrated, rightly so, with Putin's continued bombardment of Ukraine, even while Putin says he's willing to have conversations. So I'm glad to see that that President Trump is figuring out President Putin. He's figuring out that President Putin is not serious about these negotiations, not serious about a ceasefire, not serious about peace. So we have seen this, as you say, the shift in tone in some of these comments, but we have not seen any action yet, and that's what it's going to take.
So after Trump posted on social media that Putin has gone crazy and that he's playing with fire, so quoting him now, Russia proposed holding a second round of peace talks with Ukraine next week. But at the last round of talks, Putin ducked a challenge from the Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky to meet, and he actually sent a lower level delegation. So what do you make of this latest offer? Does this strike you as genuine?
It doesn't strike me as genuine. You're exactly right. There's a pattern. Where the Russians try to divert the idea of sanctions, try to avert the idea that the Europeans, Ukrainians, and Americans have agreed on a ceasefire and will put sanctions on Russia if they don't show up. So he's tried this again. He suggested these negotiations in Istanbul 2 weeks ago. And exactly as you say, then President Zelensky showed up. President Trump even said he would be willing to show up, and Putin sends this low-level delegation. And then doing the same thing now. Indications that President Trump is really getting ready to do something, and the Kremlin says, well, let's have more conversations, and we're ready to do this. So this is a pattern. They're not serious, Michelle.
So, you know, Putin has held top positions of power in Russia for more than a quarter century. He could be in power for years to come. But Trump has been a very Russia-friendly president overall. And I'm wondering how that timing factors into Putin's thinking. I mean, given especially as we've seen that President Trump sometimes, you know, he gets frustrated. He's sort of suggested he might sort of walk away from the whole thing. So I'm just wondering how the timing works into the way Putin is thinking about this.
Putin's sense of timing is it's on his side. He thinks he can wait us out. He thinks he can wait President Trump out. He thinks he can wait the Americans out. He thinks he can even wait the Europeans out. I can't believe he thinks he can wait the Ukrainians out because they have demonstrated that they'll never stop fighting. But President Putin thinks time's on his side. And so unless there's a change, unless there's a a confrontation, unless we provide more weapons to the Ukrainians or put more sanctions onto Russia, serious sanctions, that will have an effect on its economy. Unless that happens, Putin's going to continue to try to wait us out.
But, you know, at the same time, European countries combined provided more aid overall, both financial and military, to Ukraine than the U.S. has, for example. So how does that factor in to what you think is happening now?
That's an important factor. It's an important recognition that the Europeans, who are much closer to the threat that Russia poses, are stepping up. They're stepping up in military terms. You talked about how the Germans now are about to provide at least the technology, if not the actual weapons, for long-range strikes. The Germans are increasing the amount of money they're putting in. The Europeans are stepping up. The European members of NATO are putting in more. So the Europeans are really stepping up. The Ukrainians, actually, Michelle, are providing, they provide 40% of the weapons that are now used in the battle come from Ukrainian sources. So that's important. The Americans do provide critical materials and capabilities, but the Europeans and the Ukrainians are stepping up their fight.
So before we let you go, what do you think is at stake for President Trump if he does not make progress on a ceasefire in Ukraine?
This is a really important question. If President Trump allows President Putin to outplay him, to continue to step him along, as President Trump has said. And if President Putin kind of wins this game that he seems to be playing, to string him along, then that will be a major defeat for the United States, major defeat for international security, but a major defeat for President Trump. Much has been made of the problems, that the disaster in Afghanistan presented to President Biden. If President Trump allows Putin to win, to outplay him, that will be his Afghanistan.
William Taylor served as U.S. ambassador to Ukraine under President George W. Bush and President Barack Obama. He's now a distinguished fellow with the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. Ambassador Taylor, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Internet celebrities Andrew and Tristan Tate, who've made offensive statements about women, are now facing a total of 21 criminal charges, according to prosecutors in Britain. As Villa Marx reports, the charges include rape, assault, and human trafficking.
It's the first time Britain's Crown Prosecution has revealed details of the charges against the Tates after a police service north of London amassed a file of allegations that date back to 2012. The brothers currently reside in Romania, where they face separate criminal proceedings over allegations they formed a group designed to exploit women. British officials say those Romanian proceedings must be settled first before the brothers can be extradited to the UK. 38-year-old Andrew is a former kickboxing champion turned social media influencer with 10 million followers on the X social media platform, where he's earned a reputation for posting about masculinity, self-discipline and wealth. British prosecutors accuse him on 10 counts tied to three alleged victims. His younger brother Tristan, who's 36, is charged with 11 offences linked to a single alleged victim. Back in 2022, Romanian authorities arrested the Tates during an investigation into an alleged sex trafficking operation, and they spent months under house arrest. But a travel ban on the pair was lifted recently, and in February, the two dual US-UK nationals flew to Florida on a private plane, before returning to the Romanian capital of Bucharest in March. At the time, Andrew Tate told reporters he'd continue to travel wherever he chose.
I'm not convicted of any crimes. I'm a free person who has not been convicted of anything, just the same as you are or anyone else here. So I can take a holiday anywhere I want.
In the UK, four other women in separate civil proceedings have sued Andrew for alleged rape and physical abuse. The brothers have continued to deny all charges and vowed to prove their innocence in both Romania and the UK. British prosecutors, meanwhile, reminded the public in a statement that the brothers remain innocent until proven guilty. For NPR News, I'm Villa Marx in London.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, comic actor and writer Sarah Silverman. Whether it's talking about sex, abortion, being Jewish, racism, or just everyday life, she's willing to take risks to make a point and make it funny. We'll talk with her about her new comedy special, Postmortem. It's about the death of her father and stepmother, 9 days apart. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses, from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at progressivecommercial.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Energy Secretary Chris Wright is a former Colorado oil and gas executive who calls himself a climate realist. He acknowledges that the planet is getting warmer, but doesn't believe it's a crisis. Now he's leading a department that's charged with developing new climate-friendly energy sources. Sam Brash of Colorado Public Radio has this report.
This spring, Wright returned to Colorado, where he built his fortune leading a company offering fracking tech for the oil and gas industry. His first stop, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Golden.
I had a tremendous day at NREL today.
The lab focuses on renewables like wind and solar. That research is a core function of the Department of Energy, and it made the agency central to Biden-era climate efforts. NREL is also near the location of the 2021 Marshall Fire, the most destructive fire in Colorado history. So, during the visit, a reporter asked Wright about a post where he called concern about climate-driven wildfires just hype.
The hype is climate alarmism, and it's 100%. Calling climate change a crisis is just to say, I'm not going to look at the science, I'm not going to look at the economics, I'm just going to run with the politics.
Wright says he's more pragmatic. He acknowledges burning fossil fuels is heating the planet, but says that's a manageable problem.
Like, it's a real physical phenomenon. It's worth understanding a little bit. But to call it a crisis and point to disasters and say that that's climate change, that's to say I'm not going to do my homework.
Wright often argues disasters like hurricanes and wildfires haven't gotten more frequent. That's despite a scientific consensus that climate change is contributing to more extreme weather events. Wright didn't respond to multiple interview requests for this story, but he spent years making a consistent point. The benefits of fossil fuels outweigh climate impacts. In 2021, the outdoor brand The North Face declined to sell jackets to an oil and gas firm, citing climate concerns. Wright responded with an ad campaign, calling the company hypocrites.
The great majority of North Face's products, jackets, backpacks, outdoor pants, shirts, shoes, hats, etc., are dominantly made out of the oil and gas that we so proudly produce.
And the YouTube videos and billboards carried the same message.
So thank you, North Face. And you're welcome.
The spat landed Wright on Fox News. In later podcasts and talks, he argued fossil fuels have pulled billions out of poverty and remain essential to modern life.
All these fancy materials, and we can fly around the planet and drive a car to go visit grandma for dinner 100 miles away. These were just unimaginable before the arrival of fossil fuels.
Scott Denning is a climate scientist at Colorado State University who debated Wright in 2015.
What he's implying, without even really claiming it, is that the only way we can continue to live modern lives is to continue digging up 10 billion tons of carbon a year and setting them on fire forever and ever, which is simply not true. That's just malarkey.
Denning says the world now has more energy options, and Wright downplays the risks of living on a hotter planet.
It's pretty naive to say, oh no, we could just turn the temperatures up to like South Texas around here in Colorado, and we won't have any impacts on water, on fire, on drought, on livestock, on forestry. I mean, come on.
But some clean energy advocates are more hopeful about Wright, pointing out he often says the country needs abundant energy from multiple sources. Sure, his company played a key role in the recent shale gas boom, but he's also invested in more climate-friendly alternatives, like geothermal and nuclear. That's good news for Jigar Shah, who led an office focused on green tech under President Biden.
Chris Wright knows better than anyone that shale has plateaued, right? And so now we need to diversify where we're getting our energy from. And we need nuclear, we need geothermal, we need these other technologies.
And that's what the Department of Energy has been working on. But so far, the Trump administration has opposed clean energy incentives and cut staff at the DOE. So even if Wright supports alternative energy research, Shah says it's not clear if he can pursue it. For NPR News, I'm Sam Brash in Denver.
For years, people across Nepal have complained about monkeys stealing food from their homes and farms. Now the government is conducting a monkey census to understand how bad is their monkey problem exactly. NPR's Omkar Kandakar in Mumbai has this report with Rajneet Bhundari in Kathmandu.
At a crowded marketplace, Samuna Shrestha guards her fruit shop with a slingshot. She's got her eye on two monkeys scratching themselves on a nearby rooftop. She says she can't take her eyes off them for even a second, or they will swoop right in. Their favorite thing to steal is bananas, but even mango juice or cheese balls will do. Such thieving monkeys are on the loose across Nepal. News channels report on their troops besieging villages, storming into kitchens and farms, and feasting on fruits and corn. Locals say they have tried chasing them with sticks, hurling firecrackers, blasting loud music. Some municipalities have tried to catch and relocate monkeys into the forests. Nothing's worked. So last month, Nepal tasked a team of 18 zoologists and wildlife experts to do the country's first ever monkey census. Dr. Hari Prasad Sharma is the census coordinator. He says the team visits neighborhoods with known monkey populations, counts them individually, and calculates an average. But it's not been easy.
When they see us, and then they always becomes angry.
So he says, while counting monkeys, his team avoids making eye contact with them. The first phase of the census, which focuses on the worst affected areas, will end in October. Policymakers will then figure out what to do. Sharma says monkeys entered human settlements because humans entered theirs. They cut down fruit trees, exploited water bodies, and caused global warming. He says it's a man-made problem.
But we are blaming other animals.
Yet monkeys get a bad name. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Mumbai.
This is NPR News.
When Israeli author Edgar Keret read his manuscript on October 6th, 2023, he was worried it was too dark. But when he came back to the collection of short stories months later, his country now plunged into a brutal war.
Suddenly I understood what it was about. It was how to stay human in inhuman times.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. That conversation on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A federal court says President Trump cannot use an emergency powers law to enact sweeping tariffs on U.S. imports. The ruling from the Court of International Trade in New York was in response to lawsuits filed by a dozen states and several businesses that argued the president was exceeding his authority. The British government is reacting cautiously to the ruling, as Villa Marx reports.
Britain says the U.S. trade court's rulings on tariffs were, quote, matters for the United States to determine domestically. The statement went on to note that, quote, this is only the first stage of legal proceedings. The court decision, although already under appeal, severely undercuts the president's trade negotiating strategy that relies on the threat of sweeping tariffs on goods from dozens of countries. Britain struck the first provisional agreement with the U.S. to reduce those tariffs, and its leaders have talked up this negotiating success. The government statement said the UK was, quote, working to ensure that businesses can benefit from that deal as quickly as possible. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx in London.
Aid groups say the distribution of food and other supplies in Gaza continues to be chaotic. It's being done by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, backed by Israel and the U.S. Dr. Feroz Sidwa is an American trauma surgeon who's volunteered in Gaza. He spoke to the U.N. yesterday.
There's a limit to what human beings can actually endure, and I think we should stop pushing them to that limit.
This is NPR News. More testimony is expected today in New York in the federal sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy trial of hip-hop mogul Sean Diddy Combs. Yesterday, jurors heard from a former employee of Combs who testified to the abuse of singer Cassie Ventura. NPR's Anastasia Asiolkas has more on this report, which includes mentions of physical and sexual violence.
Deontay Nash is a fashion stylist who worked with both Sean Combs and Cassie Ventura. He said he witnessed Combs threatening and beating Ventura on multiple occasions, including one which resulted in a gash near her eye. Judge Arun Subramanian also denied the defense team's request for a mistrial after they argued the prosecution suggested Combs was responsible for the destruction of evidence related to an incident in which musician Kid Cudi's car was set on fire. The next witness scheduled to take the stand is a woman who will use the pseudonym Mia and who worked as an assistant to Combs. Prosecutors have said Mia will testify that Combs sexually assaulted her on at least two different occasions. Anastasia Tsoulkas, NPR News, New York.
In Canada, a state of emergency is in effect in Manitoba because of expanding wildfires. Thousands have been told to evacuate. On Wall Street in early trading, the Dow's up 43 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Leila Faldil in Budapest. Today, American and European populists, nationalists, and conservatives are gathering here in Hungary for the fourth consecutive year for the Conservative Political Action Conference. It was kicked off by Prime Minister Viktor Orban.
The Trump tsunami swept through the world and changed the entire world. It gave back hope to the world. We're no longer suffocating in the woke sea.
In recent years, American conservatives have looked at Hungary and Orban as an aspirational model for not just getting elected, but implementing his agenda. He's led the country for the last 15 years and won four consecutive elections. Critics say he's done that by corroding democratic institutions. It's a concern that has the European Union withholding billions of euros that were allocated for Hungary. But the U.S. chairman of CPAC, Matt Schlapp, says it's Orban's nationalist policies, like stopping migration, that keep getting him reelected. We met Schlapp in his hotel lobby in Budapest on the eve of the conference to talk about the deepening alliances between the MAGA movement, Orban's Fidesz party in Hungary, and other right-wing movements in Europe. He says what's uniting them, in part, is a feeling that their political opponents were the ones who were being undemocratic. A point he made repeatedly.
See, I felt like America's institutions were definitely in an autocratic slide. I felt like I couldn't get a fair shake. People who have CPAC-type values couldn't get a fair shake in the major national media. We couldn't get a fair shake in the big city courtrooms. We couldn't get a fair shake when it came to having corporations be neutral on politics. They seemed to all get involved in every left-wing political cause of the day.
Schlapp was in neighboring Poland earlier this week for its first CPAC gathering. He told me to expect to see more of these gatherings around the world in the years to come.
We'll be doing CPACs in Australia, in Japan, in Argentina, in Colombia, in Mexico, in other places. The one thing it's undeniable is that everybody wants to know where Donald Trump is on the issues that matter to their country. If their country's under duress, almost all of them are really happy that he's the president because they feel like that change will make a big difference. People can have their opinions on Joe Biden, but most people who are suffering around the world suffered worse after his policies. Maybe they weren't intended, but the weakness of the American presidency, the fact that he wasn't an all-the-time president, had a negative effect on a lot of these countries. And they're really rooting for Donald Trump to succeed.
Would you like to see, taking it to this sort of global stage, we're sitting in Budapest, would you like to see more MAGA-like movements here in Europe?
Well, it's weird because MAGA, Make America Great Again. When I go to these countries, I'm always shocked. Poland, a lot of Trump hats. The first time we had CPAC in Japan, there was a ton of MAGA hats. And I thought it was like, Make Asia Great Again. I didn't really understand, like, why are they wearing a MAGA hat? And a woman came up to me through a translator and said, I wear a MAGA hat because you have a president who understands our number one enemy on the globe is the regime in China. This is what's happening all around the world. I don't think people understand that there is a rethinking, a chucking of the status quo establishment. In most of the countries around the globe, they view the center-right parties, which is where I come from, as having failed them. They didn't fight hard enough for the things that they care about. New parties are sprouting up, and it's a fascinating thing to be a part of.
When you think about after Donald Trump's term, a future leader, is there a Trumpism after Trump, a MAGA-like movement?
Well, the people that get up every morning and listen to NPR might be hoping that this was an aberration, that this is something of a cult of personality movement, and that when Donald Trump isn't the president anymore, this will go back to some kind of normalcy of what the situation was before. And what I've had to explain to people over the course of this, certainly the last 5 years, is if you refuse to listen to what's happening in politics, you'll continue to be surprised by what happens in politics. And when you actually listen to the people around the country, it shouldn't surprise anyone that Donald Trump won. You could see the fact that people felt dissatisfied with both parties, but certainly were very dissatisfied with the fact that the Democratic Party moved so far to the left. This has changed American politics, even when Donald Trump is no longer a candidate.
Are there policies here in Hungary from Viktor Orban? He's been in power now for 15 years. He's a very divisive figure that you think the U.S. should embrace.
You know, he's a unique leader because one of the reasons why he has a strong bond with President Trump is he had power and then he lost power and then he found a way to regain power. And they're different people. I've spent a significant amount of time with each of them, but I wouldn't call them the same. Mm-hmm. But they have some similar characteristics, which is they understand that to be successful in the current environment in this country and in America and a lot of other important countries, do you accommodate the globalists or do you fight the globalists? Now, you said he's controversial. He's controversial because he'll actually fight on questions like immigration. So what's happening in Europe is the EU wants to dictate to these countries how many migrants they take. And what Orban and the people of Hungary are saying is, no, we're going to determine what our immigration policy is. Most people who I associate with view it as the most common sense thing in the world. Why would anybody be able to live legally in Hungary without the government of Hungary being able to say that it's okay?
Is there anything that you've seen here in Hungary that you want to take back to the U.S.?
I think that the prime minister understands that if your population rates continue to go through the floor, go through the basement, it is an indication of an economic winter that's coming. And the only way Hungary exists for another 100 years if there are people, Hungarian families who want to have kids. And of course, abortion plays into this, and his tax policies have actually resulted in a big drop in the number of abortions without making abortion
tax
less legal.
For having
yeah,
kids.
Basically, mm-hmm. it's an interesting, and this is a debate we have within conservative circles. You know, is it about barring abortion or is it about making young women feel the security that they could raise their kids and have enough money and have childcare and those questions?
We were talking to Hungarians across the country, some who support his policies over the economy and others who really feel like the institutions are sliding into an autocratic place.
I've talked to tons of Hungarians who feel mm-hmm. like it's Brussels that are the autocrats. Mm-hmm. It's the UN that are the autocrats. It's the WHO that are the autocrats that tell doctors how they should prescribe medicines and stuff. So this is the craziness of the moment we're in. This is why over the next few years, you will see more populist conservative victories, because the people see those large global institutions as actually being the autocrats. Not the saviors of the little guy, but the ones dictating to them policies that make their lives worse.
That was Matt Schlapp, the chairman of the Conservative Political Action Conference, speaking to me here in Budapest. Elsewhere in the program, today and tomorrow, young Hungarians explain why they're choosing to leave, and activists weigh the risks of defying an effective ban on pride celebrations.
I don't want to lose my job, but I also don't want to give up my values.
This is NPR News.
President Trump is using his pardon power again, this time pardoning reality TV stars convicted of a $36 million fraud scheme. The power of the pardon, next time, here and now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. A forest ranger in New York's Adirondack Mountains responded to an emergency call this week. Two hikers said a third member of their group had died. But when the ranger found the pair, he discovered they were in an altered mental state. They had taken hallucinogenic mushrooms. The third hiker was totally fine. The high hikers went to the hospital. The ranger took the third to their campsite, where they eventually reunited. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. From National Geographic Lindblad Expeditions, committed to taking travelers deeper into the wonders of planet Earth. Each expedition cruise is guided by a diverse team. natgeoexpeditions.com/cruises. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. At colleges and universities across the U.S., football coaches are often among the highest paid people. Does that make economic sense? Darian Woods and Adrian Ma from Planet Money's The Indicator checked in with some folks in a position to know what makes coaches so valuable.
Greg Byrne is the University of Alabama's athletic director. So he's the one that hires the coaches. And, you know, we actually spoke to him mid-game.
We're up 2-1 on Missouri in the bottom of the sixth.
Last year, Greg hired football coach Kalen DeBoer for an annual salary of almost $11 million. And he said, look, the football team turns a very healthy profit, but then they have a lot of other sports that don't make money.
And so it's an economic model where football is the engine that pulls the train. To not only is, offer great opportunities for your student athletes, it's a way to get people involved and engage with your university.
Greg argues that a top coach also means a better football team, which means more ticket sales and also more buzz that can boost enrollment.
Okay, so case closed. It makes economic sense for colleges to pay top dollar for football and basketball coaches.
Not so fast, Adrian. Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist at Smith College.
Unquestionably, there are individual cases of it, but the general phenomenon is no, they don't benefit.
He's looked at what happens when a new coach is brought in with a high salary.
You know, if you're paying some coach $7 million and there's not a $7 million spike in revenue, then it's not paying off for you.
In fact, Andrew finds that in the top leagues, athletic departments are each losing an average of $20 million or more a year. But what about increasing the school's brand?
Basically, that evidence is not robust.
So in general, if building up a top athletic department in a college does not make economic sense, why is it so widespread?
The explanation is that it's an artificial market. It's not a normal business commercial market.
Andrew says we shouldn't think of the market for football coaches as free markets, like the market for, I don't know, sandwiches or living room furniture. And he has five reasons. First, college sports has a bunch of tax benefits. Secondly, these programs are publicly owned, meaning they don't have private shareholders demanding they turn a profit each year. Third, there are often large subsidies from the university and state governments. Fourth, the students often subsidize sports through their college tuition. And finally, until recently, college athletes didn't get paid, and so there was more funding available for the coaches' salaries.
You don't have any of the normal discipline that happens in a typical commercial market. And for that reason, even though college coaches are being paid, it can be argued, a market salary, it's a very artificial and jiggered market. The few college presidents historically who have stood up and said this is unacceptable, they've gotten their wings clipped.
A 2009 survey of university presidents with major football programs found that 85% felt that football and basketball coaches' salaries were excessive, but they felt they couldn't control them.
Greg says students do not subsidize Alabama's football coach because the football program pays for itself. And maybe Alabama is a special case where it does pay off, but not every college can be a superstar school.
Darian Woods,
Adrian Ma, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Budapest. We've been in Hungary all this week reporting on why many American conservatives are enamored with this small Central European country's leader. They point to Viktor Orban's unapologetic approach to dominating state institutions and using state funds to implement his vision. We've been especially curious, given how many Hungarians say they're watching their democratic institutions crumble under Orban and his party. It's gotten to a point that many young people here say they're looking for a way out until something changes.
Welcome. This is us, Endgame Academy.
Can you tell us? Rita Nadish is the head of education at this after-school program, Endgame Academy, here in Budapest. It prepares students ages 13 to 19 to study abroad for university. She says their research shows the motivations for leaving have shifted. It used to be more about the quality of education and opportunities abroad, but now the number one reason is to get away from the political situation at home.
And feel free to have a look around. This is our main room, I would say.
Okay. So there's a bookshelf filled with English language standardized practice tests. Students who aren't in class are curled up on orange beanbags studying.
Let's sit down.
Nadesh ticks through some facts. They have about 300 students, many on scholarship, tuition's about $4,000, and then she gets right into why so many students want to leave Hungary.
We have been living in what you are living now since Trump. Everything that is happening now in the US, we have been living it for the past 15 years. So we are talking about the Orban government, which is methodically trying to stifle criticism. We experience it day by day. This means a very heavy centralization of education, the scrapping of the Ministry of Education. I think this sounds very familiar.
How did the dismantling of the Ministry of Education impact the public school system? I mean, did it make it much different than it was before?
It's probably not the dismantling of the Ministry of Education per se, it's the centralization. So many powers were removed from the schools. Principals now don't have the power to hire or fire anyone. They don't have the power to order new equipment. Universities is another thing. Universities cannot anymore make decisions on how they spend their money on their own. So they have this upper body that decides it for them.
Would you still describe Hungary as a democracy?
Well, define democracy, we can vote. And there are no black cars pulling out outside at night like we used to have in the 50s. So perspectives, this country has seen awful things in the past 1,000 years, really, that compared to that, this is a democracy, but what we would call a liberal democracy is very far from it.
It's interesting because, you know, people keep talking about the way that dissent is being stifled here.
Yeah.
And yet people still speak, like you speak. How does it present itself when you talk about stifling? How does it work?
It's having your favorite newspaper shut down. It's seeing people being afraid to post online if they are working in the public sphere. It's my son asking me if it was okay for him to wear a girly shirt or something in pink and then go outside. What do I say?
Nearby, one of her students, Zsófia Mester, is studying for finals. She's already been conditionally accepted to university.
I'm going to the Netherlands, specifically to The Hague, so I'm very excited.
Do you think when you complete your degree, you'll come back to Hungary?
I really do want to come back to help my country because, well, yeah, it needs a lot of help and development, but it really depends on the government.
What would need to change? Is there anything specific?
If the government party changes, there is a higher chance for me to come back.
I ask her why.
I think it's mainly what they represent in a way that the laws and the bills they introduce in the parliament, it's how they don't want a diverse country, internationals coming here, how they treat Hungarians, how they treat people who do not agree with them. I don't want to be a part of it anymore.
And she says that's a really hard thing to say because she loves Hungary, her family, her friends, and her culture. but she doesn't like what it's becoming under this leadership.
Scientists are still trying to figure out exactly how microplastics affect human health. The tiny particles can be thinner than a strand of DNA, and some early research has found possible links between plastic exposure and health problems. One thing that's clear, though, plastics are getting into our bodies, and how we prepare food could be a big reason why, NPR's Joe Hernandez reports.
Tracy Woodruff is a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, where she studies microplastics.
One of the most important sources of microplastics is through the food that we eat. And it's highly likely that a lot of that comes from food contact materials.
Think plastic spoons and spatulas, cutting boards, and plastic wrap. Anne-Marie Bonneau wrote the book The Zero Waste Chef. She decided to break up with plastics in 2011 over concerns about pollution, but came to recognize the potential health benefits too. The switch posed some challenges.
If you want to cut plastic, you know, you're going against this system the way it's set up. It's not easy.
Still, Bonneau says there are a few kitchen items that are easier to replace than others.
You can use a wooden cutting board, store food in glass or metal, save all your jars.
She recommends cooking in cast iron or stainless steel pots and pans and heating food in a ceramic dish instead of a plastic container. Chef Edward Lee ditched plastics at his restaurant Shia in Washington, D.C. He says it's had some positive unintended consequences. Take, for instance, doing without squeeze bottles for things like sauces and condiments.
One of the byproducts of getting rid of squeeze bottles is that all our vinaigrettes are fresher because we have to make them to order.
Lee says the transition has made staff more creative. He said some of the restaurant's chefs have even purged items in their home kitchens, too.
Once you do this, you realize, like, there's no going back. And I think that's the biggest thing that we want to encourage people. It's a mentality.
So while these chefs say that it might be inconvenient to forego plastics in the kitchen, substitutions are possible. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin.